Welcome to KG News Morning Magazine. It's Thursday, February 3rd, 2022. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we hear about how a county in western Colorado is trying to stop methane from seeping out of abandoned coal mines. After that, tomorrow is National Hemp Day, so we'll hear about hemp news, past and present, on today's Cannabis Report. Then we learn about a team of researchers using drones to understand how the Marshall Fire spread. Finally, food columnist and Radio Nibbles host John Lendorf will catch us up on local food news. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have the BBC news headlines. Then it's a public affair. In our first half hour, Stacey Johnson will share interviews she recorded at the most recent Boulder County Soil Revolution Conference. Then Niall Southern chats with local farmers on the last day of the community-supported agriculture market of the season. At 9 a.m., I share highlights from a town hall meeting last week with Boulder state representatives. At 9:30, Dennis Ryder will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that is still ahead, so stay tuned to your community radio station. But first, we'll start with headlines with KGNU's Benita Lee.
Denver public safety officials say a third police officer was suspended for using excessive force during a peaceful protest against the murder of George Floyd. A disciplinary letter described how Officer Jesse Trudell used pepper spray twice without justification. Trudell pepper sprayed a protester in the face. Moments later, he sprayed again as protesters heckled him and other officers. Trudell told investigators he feared for his safety and that he was under attack from rocks, bottles, and incendiary devices. Trudell served a 6-day unpaid suspension last month. Two other officers, Diego Archuleta and Derek Streeter, were suspended last year for violating the department's use of force policy during the racial justice protests. A prosecutor says no charges will be filed against two workers at a Glenwood Springs amusement park where a 6-year-old girl died last year. District Attorney Jefferson Cheney said that he could not prove that either worker acted with criminal negligence. The parents of Wangel Estefanos issued a statement saying that the DA and the amusement park treated their daughter's life as, quote, cheap and meaningless. The parents filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the park in October. They claimed that investigators say the two ride operators did not notice that Wangel was sitting on her lap belts when they began the Haunted Mind Drop ride. A Colorado amusement park licensing agency fined the Glenwood Caverns Adventure Park $68,000 because the workers overrode a security alarm that warned of the seatbelt problem. The girls' parents say they'll go to civil court to prove their case. They allege that repeated recklessness and improper training led to their daughter's death. Denver Public Schools aim to cut jobs in its central office as school enrollment declines. Steve Miller has more.
DPS Superintendent Alex Madero said he will lower the size of the central office, freezing some vacant positions and reducing the number of executive-level positions. Colorado Chalkbeat reports that Madero's goal is to drive more district dollars directly to schools. Colorado school districts are funded per pupil, so when a school loses students, its budget shrinks. DPS enrollment is expected to decline 6% by 2025. Manetto said as the DPS enrollment is declining, adjustments should be made to reduce the central office budget, just as a school makes adjustments in its budget. A Chalkbeat analysis of the 2016-2017 school year found that the DPS's central office was top-heavy. Then in 2019, after a teacher union strike, then-Superintendent Susan Cordova cut 150 positions from the central office. The cuts freed up about $17 million. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
The Douglas County School District canceled classes for today. Hundreds of teachers and other staff are taking the day to protest attempts by some school board members to oust Superintendent Corey Wise. Those members allegedly tried to force out Wise without consulting the entire board. The protest is also aimed at the district's decision to change its equity policy. Some school employees fear that it will lead to the county teaching critical race theory. Following November board elections, four new members voted to change the district's equity policy. The policy was passed during the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020, following the murder of George Floyd. The city of Louisville is installing air quality sensors at city facilities. The Purple Air brand of sensors uses lasers to measure airborne particles such as dust, smoke, and other pollution. Louisville residents can also purchase a Purple Air sensor for their homes at a discounted price. If sensors detect unhealthy or hazardous air quality, residents are encouraged to limit outdoor activity or wear an N95 mask outside. Denver community planners unveiled a proposal Wednesday that would require new residential projects to set aside a portion of apartments or condos for affordable housing. The proposal is a city effort to lessen its housing crisis. If the plan is approved, new housing developers would have to offer 8 to 15% of units as income restricted for 99 years. City officials are expected to vote on the new policy this spring. Denver is inviting the community to offer feedback at denvergov.org/affordabilityincentive. Sunny throughout the Front Range today, but still chilly. In Boulder, a high near 19 and wind chill values as low as negative 3. In Denver, highs near 21 with wind chill values there as low as negative 9. In Fort Collins, mostly sunny with a high near 18 and wind chill values as low as negative 12. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
You're listening to The Morning Magazine. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. As the impacts of climate change worsen, many are turning their attention to the harmful greenhouse gas, methane. Scientists estimate that methane is 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide. As part of our Rocky Mountain Community Radio series, Eleanor Bennett from Aspen Public Radio reports on how Pitkin County in western Colorado is working to capture methane that's leaking out of abandoned coal mines.
It's late September, and the Crystal River Valley is aglow with golden aspen leaves framed by snow-capped peaks. Local climate scientist Chris Kasky is crouching in front of an old mine portal and coal basin that's been filled in with rocks and dirt. Kasky is using a methane sensor to show a group of local stakeholders where a steady stream of air and methane is leaking out from a small hole in the porous earth.
You can see those little wild roses are blowing in the breeze. That breeze is mostly air that's entering down lower and coming up through, but we measured it earlier. It's almost 2% methane by volume.
Coal Basin was once dominated by coal mines that first opened in the late 1800s.
This coal was saturated with natural gas, mostly methane, and that's just for geology reasons. And that methane is a miner safety hazard. So during mining, it was vented to protect the miners. And that methane has continued to leak out ever since.
When the last of the five mines shut down in the early 90s, the mining company was mandated to restore the area. But Kasky estimates the mines are still leaking over 1 million cubic feet of methane every day. According to local officials, that's equivalent to over half of Pitkin County's reported CO2 emissions each year.
That includes all the traffic, all the houses, all the aircraft landing at Aspen Airport. And Pitkin County being wealthy is not a low footprint place.
Kasky says the methane seeping out of the mines isn't concentrated enough to impact hikers or bikers, but it is making its way into the atmosphere and contributing to climate change.
It's a huge opportunity to reduce climate pollution, because if we can capture this gas and either use it or just destroy it by burning it, that is a very good thing to do.
Representatives from State Senator Michael Bennett's office, Pitkin County, Holy Cross Energy, and others hiked nearly 9 miles with Kasky to witness the problem firsthand. For Pitkin County Commissioner Greg Poshman, the trip made the benefits of taking action clear.
This may be the easiest way to get a huge bang for our buck to reach our carbon goals, certainly by 2030, if not sooner.
Kasky says the cheapest solution would be to burn the methane, which creates CO2 instead.
And that really looks like wasting it, but right now it's already being wasted, and CO2 is less bad for the atmosphere than methane.
Another option is to use the gas leaking out of the mines to generate electricity. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, there were only two other projects of this kind in the country as of 2019. Kasky estimates Coal Basin could produce enough electricity to power about 2,000 homes. But the mining area is located on a mix of Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, and private land. So Pitkin County will need to get permission from individual landowners as well as the federal government. Mona Newton is the executive director of the Aspen-based Community Office for Resource Efficiency. She and the stakeholder group have sent letters to state and federal officials asking for their support. But she says the project shouldn't be used as an excuse for Pitkin County to keep polluting the atmosphere.
We can't stop working on the emissions that are generated within Pitkin County, but this will go a long way towards helping to preserve our climate.
If the project gets approved, construction could start as soon as next year. Eleanor Bennett, Aspen Public Radio News.
And now it's time for the Cannabis Report here on KGNU Community Radio. I'm Hanalee Myers, and as always, I'm joined by KGNU cannabis correspondent and longtime marijuana reporter Leland Rucker. Leland, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
I'm here.
So tomorrow, Friday, is National Hemp Day, and you're going to bring us up to speed on all things hemp?
Yeah, well, not all things hemp, but at least some things hemp. Let's put it that way.
Please do.
Hemp's been around for a long time. Humans have been interacting with hemp for centuries. Humans used hemp fibers to make fabric for clothing and other materials. Our founding fathers brought hemp with them to the New World, demanded that farmers grow it. And after it was banned, because it comes from the same plant as marijuana, it was banned in the United States during World War II, farmers were encouraged during that time for 2 years to grow hemp for military use. Even though it was banned, they were still urged to grow it for military use. So though it's been an essential material in several industries, the government banned it in the 1930s, along with marijuana, which left its production to other countries. And since the passage of the Farm Bill of 2018, we've been slowly trying to change that. In 2018, hemp was rescheduled to a Schedule 5 classification from its Schedule 1, and that's the same as codeine. So as a result, the growing, producing, and distribution of hemp are legal on a national level. Products made with hemp, like CBD, oils, clothing, plastics, paint, insulation, biofuels will now be more readily available, or at least we hope they will, from local farmers. And it also means the U.S. can catch up with other countries in processing hemp, because we're like 70 years behind right now. And, you know, hemp and marijuana both come from the cannabis sativa plant, but the varieties that are grown to make industrial hemp and those that are grown for medical and recreational marijuana are genetically bred for different things. Some are bred for high concentrations of THC, delta-9, tetrahydrocannabinol. But hemp is high in fiber, and it's used in everything from body oils to building materials, and nobody can get high from smoking hemp, nor would anybody even want to. You wouldn't even want to try. So by federal and state definition, hemp can have no more than 0.3% on a dry weight basis of THC. That's so minuscule. Most legal marijuana strains in Colorado are at least 15% THC. So this has been a problem. It continues to be a problem. The main reason is because the 0.3% was arbitrary. It wasn't based on science. It wasn't based on data. It was a number chosen at random in 1976 by a couple of Canadian horticulturalists who wrote an article about taxonomy and cannabis. And still, 45 years later, lawmakers, public policy institutes are still referencing Small's articles while shaping the law of the land. There have been efforts, really a lot of efforts, to make that number 1.0, which would be fine, but so far, no good. Now, Colorado was an early state to adopt its own hemp rules. Colorado got on the bandwagon quickly. According to hempgrower.com, in 2020, the state produced 13 million indoor square feet with 1,037 licensed growers. That's just in Colorado. Wyoming had 25 licensed growers. New Mexico had 200. So Colorado's really at the forefront of this. And it was a free-for-all at first, mostly because people were growing hemp for CBD oil, which is the thing that most people think it's used for. But CBD oil prices fell below production costs. And now people are starting to get the idea that they can grow hemp for grain and fiber. And an economist says that by 2024, 2025, they're expecting CBD acreage to be used for those things rather than just CBD oil. And I just wanted to bring up a couple of things that show how hemp has changed. Winona LaDuke, who ran for vice president of the United States a few years ago, is offering a course, and this is a serious course, about how indigenous farmers and nations are embracing hemp. So if you're interested in growing hemp, this would be something you really want to get into. They meet weekly for 10 weeks online. It'll be going from February 15th through April 26th of this year. And then for everybody else, for the rest of us, there's the NoCo Hemp Fest. That's coming March 24th and 25th at Crown Plaza Denver Convention Center in Denver. Lots of speakers, including one of my favorites, Doug Fine, a New Mexico hemp farmer who's really a lot of fun. He's an author too. I've talked with him many times.
Didn't he write Too High to Fail?
Yes, he wrote, he's written several books on hemp growing, and he does it himself, and he's really a wonderful guy to talk with. I remember some of the earlier hemp fests, the NoCo Hemp Fest up in Fort Collins, when they were really small and just getting started, but now it's a pretty big deal. And it's all grown up now, and you can get more information at NoCoHempExpo.com. So there's lots of ways to find out more about hemp. And really, after being not available in the United States, nobody could grow it in the United States, we're just learning again. And so it's really a good time to be involved in this. And it's really good to learn that hemp is more than just something for CBD oil. Hemp has been used for centuries for all kinds of other things, and I hope we can start using it again.
Well, Leland, thank you so much for that hemp history lesson here right before National Hemp Day. We appreciate it. And you can visit news.kgnu.org and search hemp for a wide variety of some really interesting hemp stories related to hemp news here in the West. So make sure to check that out. Leland, thanks again, as always, for bringing us that cannabis news and information.
Thanks, Anna.
For KGNU, I'm Hanalei Myers.
What does it take for a community to be resilient in the face of a fire? KGNU's Stacey Johnson tagged along with experts who are using drones to survey the Marshall Fire burn zone with the hopes of finding some answers.
As the scars of the Marshall Fire continue to embellish parts of Superior, Louisville, and unincorporated Boulder County, local scientists and researchers from around the country have begun flying drones over selected Marshall Fire burn sites in recent weeks. The team, sponsored by the National Science Foundation, is attempting to capture perishable data before massive cleanup of fire debris begins. Last week, the team launched a drone in the Spanish Hills neighborhood to better understand how the area's topography may have influenced the pattern of the fire and damage to structures. Erica Fisher, professor of civil and construction engineering at Oregon State University, explains one of the focus areas of the team's data collection.
We want to understand how characteristics of housing influence survivability. So why did that house survive? Distance between the house, roofing material. Was there a burnt fence or tree touching the house? Did the house next door burn down? We want to understand that. We have been surveying homes, not just in this neighborhood. This is one of the last neighborhoods we're surveying homes in. But we've surveyed homes in downtown Old Superior, in the Sagamore area. We've surveyed around Mulberry area. Looking at areas where you have bigger lots, bigger homes, versus areas where you have smaller lots, smaller homes. areas where homes are really close together, areas where homes are further apart. So we want to understand, you know, in these different communities, what influence survivability. This afternoon, we're meeting with a fire department, and tomorrow we're meeting with another fire department that were here fighting the fire. Because one of the factors that influenced survivability in this fire was the fire department. And they were on the ground fighting the fire, preventing the fire from spreading.
Louisville resident and CU engineering professor Brad Wham explains what information is being targeted for the launch.
We've designed this particular area that we're going to cover. So we've got some of the burn structures here along the power line and structures that did not burn, so we can get an idea of how the fire moved through this area. So this area here is of interest to us because there's a lot of changes in elevation. And so we want to try to understand whether or not there are slopes that could be a potential problem in the future. And that's some of the perishable data we're after. What is the state of things at this time? And as the rains come in the spring, as the snow melts, do we see movements and things that may threaten new rebuilds or existing homes that are still in place?
The GEAR team expects to release its initial findings within a month to supply needed information to the communities impacted by the fire and for other research that will build upon the knowledge gained from the fire's impacts. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You can tell from the sound of Cab Calloway that it's time for Radio Nibbles. John Lindorf joins us from his test kitchen in Louisville to catch up on breaking food news. Hi, John.
Hi, Alexis. And good morning, folks. There's a ton going on locally in the food world. I'm going to try to fill you in a little bit here and catch up. The remodeled King Soopers Table Mesa store will finally reopen on February 9th. You know, almost a year after the tragedy. We also wanted to let you know that the Seeds Cafe in the Boulder Public Library has closed. You know, it was connected with the Boulder Farmers Market, and something else may open there. Unfortunately, we also heard that Scott Street Roostillery in Boulder, they say they're going into hibernation, but they say they'll be closed until further notice, which does not sound promising, and you know, it's another victim of this awful situation. On the other hand, there's stuff opening too. Boulder County's first Korean fried chicken place has opened in Lafayette.
Yum.
And I'm told that's especially crispy. Also opening soon, there's three places. Boulder Fresh Garden is opening where Doug's Day Diner was, Folsom and Arapahoe. And there's a new legitimate French patisserie and bistro opening in Lafayette shortly called Jeannot. And even better, since I like pie, you know, Maria Empanada is opening on Pearl Street where Salvaggio's was. So that'll mean within less than a mile, there'll be two places serving great Argentinian empanadas.
I love empanadas. So what's in this week's Nibbles column?
In this week's Nibbles column, I talked with the head of the Massa Seed Foundation. It's really interesting because what they're doing is producing locally grown heirloom seed that is not GMO and that you can harvest and plant again. So it's a pretty interesting discussion.
And finally, John, what is the best thing that you ate this week?
Well, I went to Barchetta Pizza, which is on the corner of Walnut and 17th. It's relatively new, but the chef there had made pizza at Pizzeria Locale, which is relatively close by. And it is just real legit, wonderful, wonderful pizza. I had just a straight ahead margarita pizza and also a potato pizza that was stunning. And they also have wine on tap, which is never a bad thing.
John will be back next Thursday with more food news. You can read John's Nibbles column at boulderweekly.com. John, thanks for joining us.
Bon appetit, everyone.
everybody eats when they come to my house.
And that does it for today's Morning Magazine here on listener-supported community radio. I've been your host, Alexis Kenyon. Special thanks today to Benita Lee, Steve Miller, Chad Reich, Hannah Lee Myers, Leland Rucker, Shannon Young, and John Lendorf for their contribution to today's program. Stay tuned for a public affair. Up first, Stacey Johnson shares interviews recorded at the most recent Boulder County Soil Revolution Conference. We'll also play the Hightower Lowdown we missed yesterday. But first, these news headlines from the BBC.